lives are built around stories. We consume them as news, entertainment, and educational content. We listen to them in sermons, and we tell them at parties. These days, every marketer worth their salt will talk about how critical it is to get their story out to customers. Is it possible to rely on stories too much? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In a world so driven by carefully crafted anecdotes, it's important to think about the ways they can be used both for and against their audiences and the invisible guardrails they create around what we think and how we feel about things. Parul Sehgal considers this in her essay, The Tyranny of the Tale. It appears in The New Yorker, where she is a staff writer. Parul, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You bring up the story of Scheherazade here, the storyteller made famous in this collection known as 1001 Nights, or sometimes the Arabian Nights. The premise framing this collection of stories is that she delays her execution by her husband, the king, by telling this different story every night. I mean, a lot of people get hung up on the content of those stories within a story because they're very compelling. But you've thought about Scheherazade herself and what her life would have been like during those days and nights.
Yeah, she became my entry point into this subject when I was starting to feel a little skeptical of story, you know, a little surrounded by story, as we all are. And I went back to her. She's so invoked by novelists. She's so invoked by nonfiction writers. And when I went back and I read the original story, I found a very different woman and a very different occasion. We don't, for example, know that Scheherazade wasn't alone with the king when she was telling the story. Her sister was in the room. We don't think about Scheherazade, as the story goes in the Arabian Nights, having three children. We don't think about the fact that the original version of the story doesn't promise us a happy ending. We don't know what happened. You know, the happy ending was tacked on later by European translators. So she seems like such a useful point of entry into expanding our notions of what story is promised to achieve.
Modern people across multiple industries use Scheherazade as a kind of fictional case study. How does she come up in articles about, like, brand management and the attention economy?
Right. Well, I mean, this is the genius of Scheherazade, we've been told, right? To sort of spin this story with this instinct for narrative pacing, with the cliffhanger, with blurring, as she does. When you read the Arabian Nights, you're never sure when one story becomes another, so you're just hooked. So you'll see her invoked in pieces about streaming, about how to keep people watching, you know, programs. You'll see her invoked as Karl Rove did in something called the Scheherazade strategy. Get people involved in a story and wrapped in a particular story. And then, you know, that becomes the alibi. You can continue to pursue all kinds of other agendas, but they're gripped in some kind of narrative. So you can see her put to all kinds of questionable uses. You know, a woman who, as I was saying, you know, is a much more complicated figure, and the story tells us a much more complicated notion of what storytelling can do, a much more modest notion of what storytelling can do, I think.
As for what counts as storytelling in the modern parlance, this is fiction and it's journalism and it's marketing and PR and TV and movies. I mean, people in different industries talk about the value of stories, but is their ultimate purpose the same?
I mean, what isn't a story? Yeah. You know, there's one famous example of these amusement park designers, and they were describing the narrative journey of the roller coasters. So it's everything is a story, everything is a narrative. And I think the one thing that unites some of these uses to which story is put is that they invoke a sense of trust. Story is told and presented to us as something innate. It's our mother tongue. It's what we share with our children. It is something that we are intimately involved in with ourselves, this notion that we're telling ourselves stories in order to live. And I think when story is being touted in this way by these marketers, by advertising, there is a way to sort of to try to sort of reach in and persuade and have something be shown to us as familiar, as something we can trust. This is something that belongs to us. So this is where I see one of those little threads connecting story when it's put to, you know, all kinds of complicated uses.
I love the phrase you coin here. Something that all uses of story seem to have in common is what you call the insistent aura of piety. That's the idea that storytelling by nature must be a good thing.
It must be a good thing. It must be a life-saving thing. You know, it must be something that in order for us to be at peace with ourselves, we have to be coherent. We have to have a story about our pasts. We have to have a story about our present. It's seen as something that can save and preserve. You know, one of the conversations I've been paying attention to for the last couple of years is, you know, comes from people very concerned about climate change and this feeling that if we just find the right story, we can persuade people to care. So there is this idea that storytelling is something very virtuous and that if we do it the right way, we can, like Scheherazade, save the kingdom.
So where does your iconoclasm come from, Parle? Why do you have concerns about our over-reliance on stories?
Why am I so grouchy? I think that anytime something is presented to me as innate and natural, I get a little bit itchy, especially because in this case, I know it's not true. I mean, I know it's not true in the sense of my own life. I definitely feel story is something overlaid on experience. And I think that what I was trying to do with this particular piece was to shake a sense of story supremacy and to remind us that there's so many other ways that we have of experiencing life. There's so many other ways that that literature and religion and wisdom has come to us that hasn't been in story, even though we're told that, oh no, everything is told to you in story. That's how we educate ourselves. That's how the civilization has, you know, perpetuated itself. When you go back and you look at the Quran, for example, it's non-narrative. Beowulf has a very odd notion of what story is. Religions, you know, come to us in the forms of riddles and parables. Not just parables, but riddles and speeches and all other kinds of literary forms. So, you know, my skepticism also joins a steady stream of people who have been skeptical of story. I think as soon as story was born, there were people looking kind of askance at it and worrying about it from Plato on. But I think in this moment, it's my own skepticism joins the skepticism of others who are trying to say, what is it preventing us from seeing and what other forms is it edging out?
So we can persuade someone of something through a story. We can also use logic and data and fact. How do stories compare with the effectiveness of those more straightforward methods of argument?
Well, the greats, you know, the proponents of story are very, very quick to sort of, as I say in the piece, fan out all these studies saying that story is uniquely effective, that it raises our sense of cortisol, raises our oxytocin, increases our cortisol, it helps us pay attention, it helps us care and remember. And all of these things are true. You know, I don't want to take away the power and the potency and the charm of storytelling. I think in my piece, I even lament the fact that as I'm writing this, I too have to invoke story. It is in our quiver. We do think in terms of story, but you know, what does it mean when we can pay attention to other forms of information? What do we know? And what I do is I turn to a number of writers, the Nobel Prize winner Annie Ernaux, Christina Sharp. I talk to, you know, I talk about a lot of people that are paying attention to the fact of we don't have to throw story away, but can we become more, can we become better readers of it? Can we understand where it has shaved off certain inconvenient facts? What does it mean to hold story? What does it mean to be a good custodian of stories? So that I think is my aim, you know, or my own aim is to become more attentive to how is story acting on me? And then when I push that aside, to sort of pay attention to ways of thinking and knowing and remembering that exist outside of story. And I talk about a few memoirs in the piece that present moments in the lives of different people, and they're not domesticated into story. They come as this swarm, this commotion of feeling. And that commotion is full of interesting information and other ways of thinking that aren't as neat and tidy and sometimes as coercive as narrative.
Do narratives get processed differently by our brains than, say, logical persuasive arguments?
That's the claim, isn't it? That that it, you know, it does even change us hormonally. And I mean, who am I to disagree with that? That is not something that I'm, you know, feel equipped to disagree with or to take down. I do think that my interest is where the claims for story are meant to elide and meant to flatten forms of skepticism that we would otherwise have.
So these days we demand stories from, say, people making asylum claims or reporting a trauma like a sexual assault. And stories may be necessary tools for communicating what's happened, but we've all been trained by other stories about what to expect, right? Which is to say, we might judge the veracity of their accounts against the ways fictional stories of the same kinds of events tend to work.
Yeah, I mean, there's this very disturbing example I don't go into in the piece, but I think it comes from the writer Nisreen Malik, who has a book called We Need New Stories. And she wrote about this case. It happened a few years ago when files of asylum seekers came to light, asylum seekers to Britain. And in the margins, the people processing the forms were commenting on the stories and judging the veracity in the sense of, oh, I wouldn't do that, or that's, you know, I don't believe you. I would have acted very different in that sense. So that notion that, you know, somebody sitting there and processing those forms already has an idea of what a credible asylum application would look like, what a credible testimony would look like, was heartbreaking to me, baffling to me, and I think became one of the reasons why writing and thinking about these sorts of questions feels urgent.
And this happens even though we know from our own lives that it's possible for a made-up, deliberately crafted story to come across as like vastly more logical and cohesive than one drawn from real life events where random things happen that don't seem to go along with the story.
You know, but stories do, they do lull. They do have this power. And one of the interesting things about some of these new books that are skeptical of stories is that, you know, they'll talk about, oh, you know, narrative is, you know, we need to be more attentive to narrative. And they just go and rehearse all the reasons why narrative is so powerful, that it's very hard to sort of look at alternatives. It does have this sway. It does allow us to sometimes forget that something lies outside of the frame, that certain details have been flattened or amplified. You know, in a way, I feel we are, as, you know, consumers of information, sometimes much more savvy when it comes to visual images. We are aware of certain kinds of manipulation. And we are conscious, for example, when we're looking at a photograph, how was it staged? Who was taking it? What was going on? And in certain ways, and I speak for myself, but stories can sort of, you know, can impart a feeling of credulity. You know, we can be carried along in them. We can be swept away in them.
Paul, your essay made me think a lot about our current obsession with true crime stories. Like, by definition, whether these are a podcast or a novel or a TV show, these are given to us in hindsight, which allows their authors to edit out all the irrelevant details that might make these stories very confusing in real life. Like, we come to expect stories about very complicated events to play out in a very reasonable, rational way.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And I think it, I mean, it's so pervasive. And yeah, no, I mean, I have nothing to say other than, as you said it better than I could, you know, it does simplify. And I do think the one thing that does trouble me are the claims for story. For example, you know, in, you know, somebody like Yuval Noah Harari will say things that, you know, Homo sapiens is a storytelling animal that thinks in stories rather than in numbers or graphs, believes the universe itself works like a story replete with heroes and villains, conflicts and resolutions. And I think that that sells us short. I think we know more than that. I think we know more than that in the context of our own lives. I think we know much more about what it means to live in all kinds of muddles and with all kinds of ambiguities. So, you know, there's a way that I feel stories like the one that you mentioned, you know, certain kinds of true crime narratives are pernicious. They flatten so many of the nuances and so many of the difficult contradictory notions that we are capable of living with and do.
In thinking about the ways that even true stories can mislead us, you remind us there are always things a story does not allow us to see. Earlier, you spoke about, you know, a photograph and how we understand that it has been staged and that things exist outside the frame. How does that happen with stories that we're just not even aware of the stories within those stories that are not being told?
You know, there's a term that I talk about in the piece. The historian Hayden White called it implotment. And I'm going to do my best to do justice to this very beautiful term. And, you know, he said that history changes when you make it into a story. It's when you look at an event and you try to put it into a narrative, the first thing that happens is selection, right? You're selecting certain details. You're making an argument, even if it feels that you're presenting things exactly how you think it happened. Every single decision you make is a choice, and every choice is an argument. It does reveal a point of view. So, you know, the notion that story is something that just exists and isn't itself a kind of loom, you know, a kind of loom that we feed facts into, has stubborn staying power, you know. And I think that one of the great places to look for skepticism of story and attention to story are actually novels. Novelists are obsessed with the idea of how story changes events. And some of the writers I mention in the piece, whether it's, you know, somebody like Muriel Spark, who used to have her characters try to run away from the story, tired of being controlled. Or you have people like Graham Greene, whose characters, one after the other, novel after novel, are just so anxious and guilt-ridden about forcing complicated human experience into three-act structures that, you know, they kind of fall apart at the end, and the books sort of fall apart along with them. So it's a wonderful place to go and see what it means to live productively with the tension. Ian McEwan is another great example, who wrote the novel Atonement. You know, his characters are always lying to the reader, and he's training you on some level to sort of pay attention and to sort of say, well, you know, what does somebody gain from telling me this story? What is the story as an alibi? How is that functioning?
Almost every story centered around a protagonist will shift an audience to identifying with that protagonist in some way, whether that person is doing good things or bad things. I still think back to a couple of years ago rewatching The Sopranos and being worried that Tony Soprano was about to get caught by the feds. I mean, I knew he's this terrible, dangerous character, and that if he existed in the real world, you would want someone like that behind bars. But it's impossible not to identify.
Yeah, I mean, this is what Plato was so worried about, that you could have these, you know, morally questionable moves candied over with all the seductions of story, you know, and then people can love the Tony Sopranos. I don't know. I think that that's a beautiful thing about stories. I do think that they do bring us closer to all kinds of consciousnesses in this way. But it has been, I think, when we're thinking about the history of story skepticism, that's been one of the strongest themes.
How do politicians use stories?
You know, how don't they use story? I mean, they're separate. There's a whole sort of, you know, shelves and shelves of books about when did politics switch to sort of presenting itself as this narrative versus that narrative? Can good story chase bad story out? And it goes back to this idea that philosophers have had, that novelists have had, that what does it mean when we conflate reality with narrative? Right, where sometimes they're brought very, very close together. And how do we unpeel them? And how do we learn to see them as separate phenomenon? We're in politics in particular. I talk about Peter Brooks in my piece. And Peter Brooks was a great, you know, scholar of narrative, and spent most of his career trying to sort of champion what it was that novels could do. And he would sort of take apart these big, important books, these classics, whether it's Madame Bovary, whether it's The Secret Agent, to sort of say, well, this is how this novel is working on you. This is why you care about this particular character. This is why this conflict can really get its fingers around your throat. And after having this long and storied career, he describes in his most recent book, The Seductions of Story, watching in the 90s, George Bush introducing his cabinet and sort of just saying, oh, you know, here's this other person, you know, here's this, I love his narrative, I love his story. And he describes this feeling, he's like, it's as if this baby bird I'd nurtured had turned into this huge predator. And he calls it the narrative takeover of reality, you know, that you can have these, as you say, these stories that can sort of sweep you away and force you into all kinds of uncomfortable, complicated identification. And he just, perhaps in his academic innocence, had not seen that it can go all kinds of places and be put to all kinds of uses.
But of course, Parle, we have evidence that humans have been telling stories for thousands of years. What do you think is different about this era when we subscribe to what you call the doctrine of narrative supremacy?
You know, the writer and literary theorist Roland Barthes said that narrative used to be seen as one cognitive capacity, and now it has become the sole cognitive capacity. And it has edged out, as you know, numerous scholars have said, other forms of communication. The lyric, for example, has fallen away, as you mentioned even before, sort of even logical persuasion. It has become sort of the way that we know ourselves, know the world. It is our expectation that things be presented as story to us. And I mean, even in my own family, I have an example of this that, you know, and I mean, I can see it in my, as time has passed, you know, if you were to ask my parents or grandparents, who were refugees from Pakistan into India, and, you know, if anything would have happened, or, oh, can you give me some advice, they would have always given you a line of a poem. Poetry was such an important, crucial part of Punjabi culture. And the notion of my being able to do that is laughable. You know, if my children would come to me, would I have some sort of like guiding poem or song lyric or something? No, I would probably give them an example of a story, something from a novel, something I'd, you know, lived with. I don't have access to that as a form of easy wisdom and communication in that same way. And this is just, in, you know, in one generation, it just doesn't seem to exist.
How do stories encourage us to embrace the information that is easiest to digest at the expense of work that is more formally challenging in the way of something like an academic study?
Well, you know, one way of looking at this, you mentioned before, and people have always said, you know, well, storytelling has always been with us. And there's a writer named Amit Chaudhry, and he writes about where he traces the sort of rise of story supremacy. And he says, you know, it happens in the 90s. And he was describing it from his context when writers from the global south were starting to be told that, you know, everybody has a story and you should tell your story. And, you know, he holds this like against storytelling symposium. And he talks about in these symposiums sort of that this was now we accept it as commonplace, but it wasn't something that was really said before with this particular way that everybody has a story to tell and what's your story. And he does trace it to this idea at that time where writers from the global south were being persuaded to come, join, tell your stories, but it was a particular story that was being chosen. It was an easier story, had some local flavor. More complicated stories didn't really have, they couldn't really find their way into the literary marketplace. There wasn't a way to brand them easily. You know, there wasn't a real way of like, what do we do with this? But a story that's, for example, very recognizably, but not too Indian in certain ways, or too, you know, Mexican, all of these, like there was, so, I mean, this is not quite answering your question, but it does go to the heart of, you know, that when we talk about stories, specific kinds of stories, and a certain kind of legibility is being expected. And I will say, though, I do think that there is more consciousness about this, and there is more sort of unpeeling about what it means to be a story. I mean, now when I listen to a podcast or I'm reading a long piece of investigative journalism, or I do feel like I will get to a place where there's, I recognize a certain move where somebody starts to talk about, well, what does this mean that this is the story? What is being left out? What does this mean that I'm taking this experience and putting it into the, you know, a structure with rising action and climax and denouement, you know? And you'll see memoirists grapple with this. And just to sort of talk about, well, what's missing? And this feels artificial, you know? So it's not that everybody's subscribing to this notion of the framework of story so easily. I do think that there is, you know, a little bit more side eye.
I mean, it does seem like a good thing, Parle, that there is more space for people to tell their own stories, particularly when they are members of marginalized groups that were overlooked before or historically silenced or controlled. I wonder sometimes, though, if we as the audience for these stories, first of all, you know, like deceive ourselves into thinking that absorbing those stories is enough, that they allow us to understand everything and sort of substitute for actually trying to change the circumstances people are describing.
Yeah, I think that I feel like there's a lot more questioning around that notion that simply reading can kindle empathy, you know, and that empathy is itself sufficient, that it counts for a form of real engagement, real thinking, real work. And I do think that there's a way when one moves away from that particular model that you can also embrace work that is a lot more formally challenging and much more difficult and not geared towards having some imagined mainstream audience pay attention to your story and care, you know? So I think that that's something that I do feel writers and critics and journalists and a lot of people paying attention to story are much more inclined to not be satisfied with that old, that familiar notion that, to read and to imagine somebody else's subjectivity is to do much of anything.
Is there also maybe an implied assumption that telling one's own story is transcendent in a way that can divert that person's attention away from demanding action?
Say more about that.
Well, I wonder if, you know, we encourage people to tell stories of trauma and hardship as if there's sort of a cleansing that comes from telling those stories and that's enough, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, this is another thing where I do feel, especially after Me Too, and, you know, the waves of testimonies of, you know, by women and some men talking about their experiences and the reckoning after the fact that, you know, and people, you know, wrote about how it you know, what was that for? What did I do? Why did I open up that moment in my life to scrutiny? What did I think would happen? What did I think that would solve? So this is another place where I do feel something turning, you know, and that, you know, the model, I think, especially of, you know, the first person essays of certain kinds of trauma and pain, you know, there's a lot more, you know, just questioning around that and what it's meant to accomplish and actually what it feels for a lot of those writers that, you know, shared their stories on the internet, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, what it means to have it just living there in this particular way. So I think that there is, again, I think some changes and thinking that I find more heartening.
Your essay also made me think about the fact that by definition, every story ends, it wraps up, that it may or may not be satisfying to its audience, but it does end. That's not how real life works.
No. And I think in a lot of the books that I've been very impressed by and moved by, Christina Sharp has a book called Ordinary Notes, in which she talks about grief, her mother, Black mourning, the afterlives of slavery. And so much of that book militates against, you know, narrative structures of closure, reconciliation, ending. It's a story that has no end. You know, it's a story where to find the beginning, it's also, you know, a complicated a complicated matter, but and then to also have an end can, in a story like this, can presuppose some kind of feeling of progress, some kind of feeling of achievement, you know? So a lot of these things, I think, these questions that you're raising, these really, you know, thought-provoking questions that you're raising, are finding not answers, but experimentation, enactment, in books and in form itself. You know, it's not a simple thing that somebody can say to the kind of question you just asked. So you have, in the course of books, you know, writers trying to figure out structurally, how do I see to this? How do I tell this story and leave it with a feeling of openness? When does that become, I think, also something that is worthy of questioning and becomes something that people should be skeptical of?
So you share in this piece, Parl, that a friend of yours who works as a biographer, a person who earns their living telling life stories, asked you, well, what is the alternative to story? What was your response to that?
Oh my God, no, my friend was appalled. My friend was very concerned. He was like, where are you sending us? Is it all now going to be this, you know, bloodless, heartless data and scatter plots? And I think that, no, I mean, I think that's the moment in the piece where I am somebody who is also professionally on the side of story as somebody who is a critic. You know, I care deeply about stories. I see all the things they can do. But I think it's a matter of becoming a better custodian of stories. And I talk about the scientist, her name is Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's the writer of the best-selling Braiding Sweetgrass. And one thing she does in her book that's really beautiful and made a big impression on me is, you know, she talks about how ecologists can learn from indigenous wisdom and, you know, kind of goes back and forth. These are the two intellectual traditions that she belongs to, you know. And as she's writing, she shows you how every form of knowledge supplants something else. And how do we live with both of them? What does it mean to take the best of both traditions? And so what I'm trying to move towards in the piece with varying degrees of success is to sort of say that, yes, there's so much that we need to enjoy and relish and be grateful for when it comes to stories, but we need to be able to see them. It's very difficult to see stories right now because we are so submerged in them. We need to be able to see the conventions of the story. We need to see, for example, the kinds of stories that certain corporations are telling and why. And then we also need to understand and make some space for the experience that exists outside of story. You know, we have to find some way, I think, of talking about some of that unruliness, some of that commotion. We need to think about what that unruliness and commotion knows, why it's hostile to story, maybe why story has been hostile to it. So these are things I think, and I told my biographer friend, I hope that they can coexist, you know, but, you know, I understood his concern.
We're all familiar with the ways that stories can help us remember things, especially those stories that we cherish and tell over and over. How might stories also contribute to us forgetting other things?
That's a very beautiful question. And, you know, it's a question that I think I mentioned her already. The French writer Annie Ernaux, who just won the Nobel Prize, takes up in all of her memoirs. There's a sense that she doesn't want to present her past to you filtered through memory. What she wants is to return to that moment. And so she becomes this documentarian of her own experience. You know, she finds ways to talk about what it was like in other ways than just sort of channeling what the room was like, the mood was like, how she recalled certain scenes. And what we get is a really radically different sense of self and of particular scenes. They're very worth reading. They're very slim, interesting books. But she's somebody who's very, very interested in finding alternatives to the way that to what memory can do. I mean, and also, like, you know, Freud said very famously that, you know, the past doesn't really, you know, exist. It exists whenever it's summoned up in memory. You know, so we're forever tampering with it and editing it and doing all kinds of post-production.
Yeah, I mean, A memoir can put the writer into this posture of thinking about the past from the perspective of someone who is already mm-hmm. far separated by years and other experiences mm-hmm. from what happened then, right? They might be writing as truthfully as they can about, say, their own childhood, but they can mm-hmm. only necessarily see that from their current perspective.
Yeah, and I think that there's a move that happens in many memoirs. It's kind of this binocular vision where you're being treated to a moment in the past, and you can see the character, for example, in the scene, in the room with her mother, and this is happening, but there's also another person, the narrating self, the writing self, right? So we're seeing that overlaid upon this memory. And more often than not, at least in my reading, it's that older narrating self who is given the good lines, is shown as having all the insight, and they can see the whole picture, and they actually knew what was happening in this context, and this was this partial piece of evidence, all of that. And I do want to argue sometimes on behalf of the self that lived through certain experiences, and to say that there were things seen then too that were rich and complicated, and sometimes without that great narrating, contextualizing self, but that are deeply worthy of thinking about and are full of information and feeling.
Why are we not? I mean, this is a strange question on its face, but why are we not able to recognize the things we don't tell stories about?
That is a strange question. I don't know if I agree.
Really?
It's a beautiful question. I was reading a book. It's a book about lynching, and it's a book about in which this historian talks about different memories that families had about, you know, family members who had been lynched, and how those memories were held, described, passed down, and very often not. There was a lot of silence around them, you know. But what she did, and I mean, this is a very, very convoluted response to you, but what she did was she talked about all the ways that families were thinking about preserving memory, using silence, but keeping some knowledge of the event alive without putting it into a story, you know? And all the reasons why putting it into a story was something that they found very wounding and very difficult and very damaging to do. So, you know, she talks to even the descendants, you know? So I don't know if something needs to be in a story to be seen. I think that we are constantly in the structures of our lives and in the structures of our silences, constantly communicating and processing our own experience and our own pasts. And I don't think, you know, some of it ever rises to the level of story. Does that make any sense?
It does.
I don't know if that makes. You know, I'd say, but you asked such a beautiful, provocative question. And I think it's something that, that again, I'm sorry to keep taking it back to fiction, but that's really where I feel like I learn a lot about what it means to live in this kind of consciousness. And the novelist, Laurie Moore, talks about childhood in this way as being something outside of narrative and those long storyless days, you know? And I think when she says that, everybody makes that noise you made, I make that noise too. It's that noise of recognition, you know, and like, I'll see this in my own children when they're just sort of unwatched, or they think they're unwatched, and, you know, the sort of texture of their days. And it's that too means something. That too is, you know, a profound state of existence.
Your essay, Parle, also made me think about the ways that religions and political parties and social organizations of all kinds, not necessarily with malevolent intentions, repeat the same stories over and over to ensure that everybody tells them the same way.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is something that, like, you know, had I more space, I would have dug into a little bit more, carefully. But there's a wonderful book I do talk about in the piece. It's called How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith. And what he does is he goes to all of these sites of historical importance in America. He goes down to I think Angola prison. He goes to Monticello and he talks to tour guides. He talks to people telling the stories. And he talks to them about how they are telling the story in this case, what he's very interested in the story of America and the story of race and the story of history and all the decisions with which they are, all the narrative decisions and choices with which they are telling this story. And from that, he goes into their lives. Why are they telling the story in this particular way? And it's a sort of book that once you read it, you become very, very conscious of how individually these stories are shaped. These stories that, as you say, can become very powerful and then must be told in very, very uniform ways. But it's a wonderful book if as we're talking, you know, to become when it comes to sort of becoming more skeptical and aware and prickly about all of this, this is a great book to give you know, an extra sixth sense when it comes to what stories you're being sold.
There are ways to sort of challenge the conventions and the expectations of stories, even in the simplest forms. You write here, I was amused to see about Goodnight Moon, the book by Margaret Wise Brown for children. It is a storyless story.
Yeah, it's a story of the story, but isn't it? What is the glamour of this particular book, right? It's something that, why does it work? And so, what I write about in this book is something that, you know, the author believed that children, you know, everybody says, oh, children ask for stories, and they do ask for stories, but what they're asking for, she always believed, you know, was the presence of the adult, you know? So you have this story that kind of is what is it? It's an incantation, it's a bunch of nouns. You know, what's happening in that moment when my own children drag me in to read the story however many times, you know? It's something else is happening, you know? But I also think that there's sometimes something else happens in the context of children and adults and stories, and children can put stories between themselves and the adults, you know, that there's another way. Sometimes when a child asks for a story, it's easier. It's a cover, it's a place to go, it's something that can hide you from the scrutiny of the adult, from too much adult attention. You know, you can ask for a story and sort of in a Scheherazade way, you know, have your own sort of agenda.
Are there ways that we can use stories better if we understand the ways that they can be deliberately or not misused?
You know, I'm sure. I mean, my confidence is that we can consume them with more care, and we can consume them with an awareness and a sense of, you know, why is this story acting upon me in this particular way? Why is this story being told to me? You know, who gains if I believe this particular story? So that kind of vigilance, you know, which doesn't detract from the pleasure of the story. You know, I was joking as I was working on this piece that, you know, is my real aim just to make everybody enjoy literary criticism, which is my own profession more. Maybe that's my own alibi in this piece. But there is a little bit of that, I think, you know. Just to you know, as they say, enjoy it responsibly, maybe.
Yeah, there is a pleasure in the same way that, you know, a lot of mental health professionals talk about sort of climbing outside one's own emotion and observing. Climbing outside a story and observing can be very grounding and very informative.
Yeah, and I think that there's something also very there's something very emancipatory. I got a note yesterday from somebody who read the story, read the piece, and she was, you know, sort of talking about her response to it, and she it's a very moving note, and she was talking about how she had arrived at a point in her own life when she really realized that, you know, she's like, I, as she wrote to me, she's like, I realized I don't live in a story and I don't live in a narrative. And she described that it happened after a very particular death and after a very particular kind of grief. And there was something about stepping out of that sense of narrative pressure, of it not having to mean anything. It didn't have to ennoble her, this loss, this grief. It didn't have to be reconciled and put into her story in any particular way. You know, it could be her own swarm of feeling and incoherence and lostness. And I just thought that was very, I thought that was very beautiful. I was like, you know, that there is something that stories can, of course, mend and bring us together, but then stories can also constrain.
Parle Sagel is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where you can read her essay, The Tyranny of the Tale. Parle, I've so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for making time.
Thank you so much.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to the podcast wherever you like to get podcasts. Look for it by doing a search for KERA Think or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.